You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Interstate Batteries has been a proud supporter of the Sportsman's Nation since day one. So if you need batteries for your truck, batteries for your trail cameras, TV remote controls, flashlights, you name it, Interstate Batteries has what you need. They have thousands of retail locations all over the United States. So stop in, talk to a battery specialist, or for more information, visit interstatebatteries.com.
Welcome to the DIY Sportsman Podcast with your hosts, Garrett Prawl and Boudreaux Boswell. I'm trying to remember, I was thinking back to when we first started talking to each other, and I want to say it was like five-ish years ago. I remember seeing a video that you had done on, I think it was your Guido's Web system and a multi-step aider and how you're using that to be able to climb. It seems like forever ago.
Yeah, that was back in 2014, not like the Guido's Web stuff, but I don't know if we had talked before or not, like, because I always watched your videos and stuff on YouTube, and I know we had talked before, but yeah, it was a little while ago.
Yeah, and you had kind of a side channel too, right? It was, you had your Flinging Arrows was kind of your main channel, but then you guys had, like, was it Extreme Pursuit or something like that, that was kind of a side channel with Hunts?
Yeah, so that was back in 2012-13, and we did it for a couple of years and then kind of let it go, but yeah, it was around the same time.
Okay. So what I really want to talk about today is your deer hunting style. You're obviously a pretty mobile hunter, have been for a long time, and you're based in West Virginia, which from what I understand, and I've never been there, it's pretty hilly terrain. You guys got some public, some private, and you guys got some land that was like old mines or something like that. And it's just in general, pretty steep terrain.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Our terrain is definite hill country, if not mountain country. So it's a lot of, you know, big timber, not a whole lot of edge to it. You know, it's kind of all monoculture, I guess you could say, but pretty tough hunting, not a lot of mature deer. We can kill 3 bucks here or throughout the season. So it's tough to find deer. It's tough to hunt a mature, I should say, but so it's definitely a challenging state to hunt, at least the area that I'm in.
Does it seem like every time a deer gets to, you know, like 2.5, like they're not many people are holding out for them because you can shoot $3 a year? I mean, it's that's part of why it's so challenging to find one that's a little bit older.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. You know, guys will shoot the first 2.5-year-old they see because they know that they have a chance to, you know, maybe hunt up or something bigger, and then usually that's the only one they get. So a lot of those younger deer get shot. So, you know, targeting a 3.5-year-old deer is pretty common for me. And, you know, I've even shot 2.5-year-old bucks that were nice deer. It's definitely a challenge. You know, it's been getting better in the past few years. There's getting to be an older age class. People are starting to pass some deer up, and, you know, I got some deer that I've killed that are 5.5, and I've known others that are even older than that. So it's getting a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be. You can never complain about shooting one like that, especially in places that aren't known for producing larger, older age class deer and have the regulations to support it. So that's definitely, I would say, from the sounds of it and just kind of seeing your, you know, following you over the years, I'd say you definitely are most likely in the higher tier in terms of being able to get the most out of what's available.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a struggle. And, you know, I've always put a lot of time into it. And, you know, before learning certain tactics here in the past few years, I would say just hunting a lot is what contributed to most of my success, just being out there as much as I could.
Now, have you always hunted mobile, or was that part of some of the learning that you've done over the last few years?
Yeah, I've actually always hunted mobile. You know, back when I first started bow hunting, my dad, we always used clay stands, and we always kind of bounce around, not hunt the same tree twice, you know, just kind of different areas to see what the deer were doing. And when, you know, when I was in my early teens and kind of started hunting on my own, you know, I just kept doing that. I always had a cover and I would move around. And if I would see deer off in the distance, I would kind of see what they were doing and see how they were having them. And I would just move in on them. And, you know, that really helped. You know, I killed a lot of deer doing that with the climbing stand. And then, you know, as it evolved, I've, you know, changed up my gear a lot and gone a lot lighter, and it's made things a lot easier. And, you know, I feel like every year I learn new things about mobile hunting and how to pick the exact spot to be. And it's definitely a learning, I guess there's a learning curve to it, you know, how to hunt that way, but it definitely helped me for sure.
So are the trees there pretty conducive to using climbing stands, or would you oftentimes with the climber feel like there was a lot of trees that you couldn't really get in, even though you may have wanted to based on what you were seeing?
Yeah, we can use climbers here pretty much anywhere because we have a lot of poplar and, you know, oak trees that don't have the limbs on them. So it's not too big a deal to find a tree with a climber around here. The bigger issue with the climbing is just climbing up hills around here. I mean, you know, we've got some pretty steep terrain, and, you know, whenever I started self-filming, you know, carrying my pack and all that stuff, you know, I was carrying upwards of 50 pounds. And, you know, if you're not in great shape, you're definitely not going to hike that far, you know, with that kind of weight, and it kind of limits you on areas that you actually want to hunt. So I'd say the weight is more of the problem with the climbing stand around here more so than the trees.
Okay. And it always seemed to me like whenever I've been in areas that are kind of that monoculture, hilly type stuff, but you get a lot of the same type of trees, and especially if you get in areas where they're maybe not quite as steep, or at least they're steep, but they're not steep enough to force deer through certain areas, it seems like during the rut, you can usually figure things out a decent amount. But I always felt like outside of the rut, it would just be really, really tough to try and get on deer consistently with the amount of food that is just kind of spread out all over the place.
Yeah, for sure. And that brings up a good point. You know, most of my deer, you know, back in, you know, when I was first learning to hunt, most of my bucks that I killed were during the rut, you know, just kind of figuring out where they're traveling and get lucky and catch one cruising. And I never killed a buck in October in West Virginia until I started diving into more of the beast tactics, like figuring out buck bedding and stuff like that. And once I kind of started putting that stuff together, you know, I've killed a buck early season almost every year since 2014, back that I can remember. So just learning some different tactics there has definitely helped. And, you know, it really helps, I guess, outside of the rut, just be consistent every year, kind of have kind of plan going into the early season and kind of executing that and then moving on more of a tactic as that time comes.
Okay. Take me back to one of the first deer that you killed using those beast tactics. Was it something that you kind of pre-scouted and found a bed, or are you just kind of assuming that the deer were bedding in a certain area based on what the topo lines look like?
Yeah, so I started rooting into the beast tactics back in like 2015 and kind of started scouting and, you know, basing, you know, my scouting tactics based off that, what I was learning there, and actually found, you know, I had an area that I'd killed several bucks out of and I never really knew why. And then when I kind of started learning about wind-based bedding and, you know, where they would bed on this certain hillside, it all kind of clicked for me. And I realized at that point why they were bedding there. So I dove into that area a little bit deeper, and I actually found the main bed that, you know, immature buckings areas can use this bed. It just sets up perfect for it. So I located this bed, and I always accessed this area from the wrong direction. You know, I really wasn't taking wind and thermals into account. So I found this bed. I started looking, you know, at a different access route, and I figured out a way to get in there. So that summer I ran a camera not too far from that bed, maybe 100 yards or so in a spot where I could check it fairly easily. So I was getting like 3 or 4 different bucks using this bedding area. And I think it was my very first sit in there with the new access route, you know, different tree that I've never hunted before. I ended up killing still my oldest buck to date. He's 5.5 years old. I killed him October 1st. I believe that's when it was, October 1st. First sit in there, he got up out of that exact bed and fed right past me, and I was able to kill him. And after that, I mean, it was like a light bulb just switched off, you know, that you actually target a specific buck bed and kill him in the early season. So it was a pretty cool hunt and still one of my favorites to this day.
Yeah, that's super cool. When you found that bed, can you describe it? You said, you know, it was set up pretty much perfectly. Was it right on kind of a knob? Was it just one big main bed, or was there a couple beds that were, you know, within a few yards of each other that he could move to? Just kind of give me a picture and explain it a little bit more.
Okay, so it's basically the side of a ridge, and the ridge runs from, let's say west to east. And on this northern side of this ridge, there's a kind of a knob on the side, you know, up toward the top of the ridge. And on that knob is actually some mountain laurel. So the ridge is mainly hardwoods, and then you've got this little knob that sets up for a southwest wind, and a little patch of laurel over there. That's about 3 acres, I would say. And main bed in that laurel is right on the edge of it, where he can, there's a little flat spot, and there's a bed right there where he can see, you know, down the hill in front of him, wind coming over his back. And then, you know, if he sees anything, you know, below him, he can turn around and go back up in the laurel thicket, and he's gone. So there's the main bed was right there on the edge. And then as you go back farther into the thicket, there's, you know, some satellite bedding that does a smaller buck use. It seemed to me like the biggest area is using that bed where he can see out from the edge of it, looking down the ridge. But it's not a very big area. It's just, you know, it's the only good pocket of cover on the side of that ridge, and it sets up for our predominant wind, which is southwest in the early season. So I think that's why it's good.
Yeah, it does sound like it sets up pretty well. So he can see out beneath him and in front of him, and then get that wind blowing from over the top through that thicket. We don't have mountain laurel out where I'm at, but there's some places where there's invasive buckthorn in hill country that does a very similar type of thing. And it's not terribly uncommon to find beds like that. So when you set up and killed that deer on October 1st, is that your opening day, October 1st, or is that just the first day that you hunted that spot?
That was the first day that I hunted that spot. I think our opener was the 28th. And then, you know, I moved in a couple of days later. I was waiting for the wind to be right. I think that season, the first couple of days, we had a weird, like, northeast wind. And then I went in there on the first southwest wind that we had. And he was in there, so.
Okay. That's what I was hoping you'd get into, is that wind direction and how you set up on there. So you waited till the perfect wind that you figured he was probably for sure going to be betting there, where it was to his advantage. So then how did you set up in such a way that you were able to catch that movement, but then still remain undetected?
Yeah. So this hunt, I came in from the bottom. So there's basically a creek bottom below this ridge. And I came in from the creek bottom, and I had to walk up a pretty steep hill, but there's a logging road that kind of cuts diagonally up the hill. And I'd say it's about 200 yards from that. So there's just enough, especially in the early season, foliage cover that he can't see that far down over the hill. So I come off the logging road out of the creek bottom, and there's basically a ditch that cuts straight up the hill, roughly 7 yards from his bed. So what I did was I used the topography to go up the road and then cut up that ditch. And then the tree that I hunted out of was right on the edge of that ditch. So, you know, I accessed with, you know, he couldn't see me because of the way the land lays. So with that ditch, climbed up the tree, and I did get pretty high because the exit trail coming out of bedding was almost eye level with me. And in going how I figured out where he was traveling out of bedding as well, there was just two or three small rubs right on the edge. Some, you know, there's some sapling that backs up to the laurel thicket itself. And there was just two or three fresh rubs coming out of that edge. And that's kind of how I figured out where he was coming out of. And where I set up at was about 5 yards from that edge. And I ended up shooting him at 40 yards, but he came just above that rub line coming out of there. So it, if he didn't follow the exact rub line, he was close enough to it. He was in range when he came out.
So did he basically stay on the same elevation line from where he got out of his bed to where he ended up giving you a shot, or did he go uphill a little bit or downhill a little bit by the time he got to you?
He was coming downhill. He was kind of side-hilling from his bed, kind of dropping in elevation. You know, he was just kind of browsing as he went. It was, you know, he stood up probably 30 minutes before dark, and it took him that long to get within 40 yards. The bed was roughly 70 yards, and I shot him at 40, and it took him, you know, almost a half hour to make that distance because he was just, you know, browsing along. So if I would have been even, you know, 30 yards farther out, you know, it would have been dark by the time he got to me. So I had to get in pretty tight.
So could you see him get up when he got out of his bed, or could you just hear him?
Yeah, I actually saw him stand up out of his bed. I couldn't see him when he was bedded, just because of the way the vegetation was. But as soon as he stood up, I could see his rack and everything, and watched him shake off and do that whole deal. And it was pretty cool.
Nice. So in that setup, and you mentioned you're pretty high up in the tree. Is it? I imagine earlier in the afternoon when you first got in there and set up, maybe you're catching some back and forth winds where you had that strong wind coming from over the top, and then maybe it would kind of lull back down and feel like the wind was getting sucked back up the hill with the thermals. And then I guess by the time you get up in the tree, was it pretty consistent? You just climbed high enough that you were getting mostly the main wind, or were you still getting kind of a mixture of wind while the sun was still up?
Yeah, so the wind that day, it was fairly breezy. If I remember right, it was like 5 to 10 mile an hour. So it was consistent enough, you know, in wind speed that I think being that high really helped me out. The thermals were definitely going uphill, you know, early part of the hunt, but the wind direction coming over the top was kind of, the thermals and the wind together were kind of going off at an angle, so they weren't going straight to him, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And then by the time he got up and got to you, had the thermal switched to start coming downhill yet, or was it still doing what it had been the whole afternoon?
Yeah, it was late enough that the wind had calmed down and the thermals were dropping. So at that point, you know, he's a bully and he had absolutely no clue that I was there. So,
have you gone back to that same spot since?
Yeah, and funny thing is, the last couple years, it hasn't held good luck. I run cameras on several different bedding areas, and that's one of them. And I just, you know, throw a camera up on an exit trail during the summer and check it like he usually wants right before season, just as standing is using it. And that spot has not produced another buck since then.
Huh. When you hang those cameras close to a bedding area, are you basically just trying to put it on an exit trail that's somewhere a little bit further away than where you would anticipate actually hunting it, so that even if they do kind of wig out when they see the camera there and alter their patterns a little bit, you'd hopefully be hunting close enough that if that was the case, you'd still be hunting on their unaltered, you know, I guess, travel routes?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, when I'm hanging cameras in the summer, you know, trying to put them in spots that I'm far enough away from bedding that I can check them without, you know, bumping them out of there. You know, and I don't really care so much that I get pictures of them in the daylight. But if I know which direction they're coming from, you know, these spots, you know, around the coastal to where I live, I've scattered out enough that I know pretty much where they're going to be. So if I can just get a direction of travel and, know, it's not too far after dark. I pretty much know where they're coming from. So I'm trying to be, I'm trying to get close enough with the cameras that I know where they're coming from, but it's also, you know, you kind of have to be careful and not get in super close to them. So it's, you know, it's a fine line to walk for sure with cameras, and you got to be careful with them, especially when you're out in, you know, buck bedding early season. You know, you don't want to go in and out of there a whole bunch. So
yeah, for sure.
It's, yeah.
Have you looked at doing trail or cell cameras at all in those type of locations?
Yeah, I do use a couple cell cameras, and I usually save those. Like, I'll kind of blanket cameras out and just run a bunch of them. And then once I start honing in on certain bucks or whatever, I'll move the cell cameras in there and kind of monitor that way. And that's been, I wish I could afford more of them. They're so expensive, but it does work really well.
Do you ever put those cameras down in the bottom areas, or are you pretty much always putting them on exit trails?
I do. It just depends. Every, you know, every situation is different. I'm just trying to put them as close as I can, you know, like I said, to hopefully know where they're coming from and not have to guess. But, you know, I don't usually run them on like field edges and stuff like that unless there's a bedding area, you know, that coincides with that, not too far away. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if I'm getting pictures of them, you know, right after dark, I kind of know where they're coming from. But, you know, it's like spokes on a wheel. You know, the farther away you get from bedding, you know, harder to figure out where they're coming from. So I'm trying to get in there pretty close.
Yeah, definitely. Do you guys, do you have the ability to shoot does too, or is it mostly just you get your buck tags to fill?
Yeah, we can actually shoot quite a few does per year, and you know, I definitely try to do that, and I have certain spots just for does, like field edges and stuff like that that are close by. But yeah, I think we can kill like 13 deer or something like that total in West Virginia, so we can shoot quite a few of them.
Oh wow. Do you guys have a ton of deer? I mean, I know, like, it seems in certain areas down south, there's a lot of deer and they're really small and you can shoot a whole bunch of them. And then there's certain areas where it's like you got bigger body deer and you only get like one tag. Like Minnesota, for example, you get like one buck tag. In some places, you don't get even a doe tag. It's right. Like hunter's choice. Do you guys have a pretty high deer population?
Yeah, in this area, we do. I mean, there's a lot of does. It's nothing to see 20, 30 does in an evening in a field. You know, in this area, you know, as you go farther south or southeast toward the mountains, you know, where, you know, the population is a lot less. So, you know, it differs from area to area, but where I'm at specifically, there's a lot of deer. I don't know what the deer per square mile is, but it's fairly high.
Okay. And then let's talk about pre-rut. Like when you're maybe past the part in the season where you got acorns that they're, and maybe at this point you're still hunting bedding. I'd be interested to figure out, but do your strategies change once you get to like late October and you start seeing more of those big scrapes pop up and the bucks are maybe starting to do things a little bit differently?
You know, close to the pre-rut, I'm trying to get, you know, still pretty close to bedding. I'm looking for that fresh sign. Start focusing more on, you know, if I find a big fresh scrape or something that's pretty close to bedding, I'll start, you know, honing in on that type of area. I actually killed a real nice buck in Ohio in 2017, right on the edge of bedding. I think it was October 28th, and we had a real good cold front come in, and I slipped in downwind of a bedding area, and, you know, he'd come out of there well before dark, and I was able to shoot him probably an hour before dark, so he was up and moving. But, you know, he was still close to bedding, but he was just moving a whole lot earlier.
Gotcha. And then during the rut, is it you're pretty much just moving to travel corridors, or are you still hunting bedding areas then?
Yeah, definitely, you know, more terrain-based travel, you know, doe bedding. You know, if I can find a terrain feature that kind of forces them, you know, funnels them down that it's between two bedding areas or something like that, that's mainly what I look for during the rut.
Okay. And do you still have, would you say, as much success during the rut that you always used to have? Or would you say that you're even more successful than maybe you had been in the past before you started learning all about the, you know, the beast style tactics and things like that?
I still have success during the rut. It's definitely more, I'm not going to call it luck. I mean, it is still partly luck, just getting them to come by you. But, like as far as patterning and figuring out a certain deer during the rut, I don't have a whole lot of luck with it. I really don't. I find myself getting more frustrated during the rut now because, you know, I don't know what specific deer are doing. So I'm mainly relying on, you know, just trying to find the best travel routes in the area and just sitting him as much as possible and hoping that he comes by. And it usually does pay off, but I definitely get frustrated with it because there's just, you know, there's no consistency to it. They're just all over the place. So these days I like the early season more than I like the rut.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the early season just because it's not as cold.
Yeah, for sure.
So you mentioned Ohio. How long have you been hunting out of there? It's not too far of a drive, I don't think, from where you're at.
Yeah, the place that we hunt at a few different places over there, about 2.5 hours. So definitely not too far. I've been hunting Ohio since 2014, I believe. So been hunting over there a few years, and I think I've killed a buck over there every year. And I find it a lot easier than where I hunt in West Virginia. So I usually save my spots in Ohio for the pre-rut and the rut, and I'll kind of, you know, I'll try to target a buck in West Virginia early season, and then if that doesn't pay, I'll go to Ohio for the rut. It seems to work out better that way. So
is the hunting pressure in Ohio, well, I guess, do you hunt public or private or both in Ohio? I've always heard that Ohio's kind of bad for public land pressure, just from the standpoint that you got all those Northeast states. Ohio is kind of the first, you know, close good deer hunting state, and everybody yep. tries to flock there.
Yeah, I'm lucky enough that I've got a few guys that we lease with, and, you know, I've always had a lease over there. I've scouted a lot of public, and I've never actually hunted it, and there is a lot of pressure on public for sure. West Virginia, not so much. I don't really see anybody on public during bow season. So in West Virginia, I'll hunt private and public both, and I hardly ever see anybody. But, you know, definitely Ohio, when you get closer to the rut, there's, you know, there's trucks parked there on the public, so there's definitely some competition.
Gotcha. Let's talk about that Missouri trip last year a little bit.
Yeah,
I think you saw more deer than I did, and I think you saw bigger deer than I did, but I felt like you got so close, and we were pulling for you. That one deer that you saw, do you think that was ended up being the same deer that Greg ended up shooting?
Yeah, for sure. That was a really fun trip, and I saw more big deer there than I've ever seen anywhere. And, you know, I came so close, like you said, that just didn't work out. I wanted to stay longer, but, you know, the gun season was coming in. But, I think that trip was like a perfect storm of weather and several other things combined that made it really, really good. I'm looking forward to going back out there this year.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to it as well. My expectations aren't going to be as high because, like he said, I think there's a lot of good things that all happened simultaneously on that trip. But either way, I think it's going to be a blast again.
Yeah, for sure. That was a lot of fun getting to, you know, help you with your buck and Greg with his, and there were several others. But man, I think it was one of those, you know, Midwestern trips that you kind of dream of during the rut. It was just the way it worked out. It was awesome.
Yeah. Is that pretty similar habitat to what you've been kind of describing earlier with West Virginia, or do you guys have even a little bit different habitat than that?
Actually a lot different. You know, we've got bigger hills here. The hardwoods are a lot thicker here, a lot more greenbrier and stuff like that. Like the hardwood where we were at in Missouri, at least there was, you know, not a lot of underbrush and stuff like that, it seemed like. Then you had those big creek bottoms and stuff, which that's a lot different. We don't really have anything like that here. You know, our creek bottoms are pretty narrow and there's not, you know, a different vegetation type. And also, you know, the creek and river bottoms in Missouri were, that was a lot different for me. Like, I don't really get to hunt stuff like that. So that was one aspect of it that I really liked. That was pretty cool to hunt something different like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Same here. We got river bottoms here too, and they're even different than what I imagine yours are like and what it was like in Missouri. So,
yeah.
Would you say that there's probably anything, I guess you mentioned beast tactics, but anything other than that that's been kind of really pivotal or where you had a big market, you know, increase in success or deer sightings or anything like that as you've kind of continued to hunt your whole entire life?
I think just hunting more mobile. You know, I started hunting with a saddle back in 2014 and then just kind of went down that rabbit hole of, you know, trying to be as lightweight as possible. And, you know, doing that has made me go further. I'm not afraid to hike farther and hunt steeper areas and thicker areas and stuff like that. And I think, you know, hunting with a saddle, you know, I've got into hunting a lot more, you know, a lot of areas that really aren't conducive to a tree stand, a lot of spots that are, you know, smaller trees and, you know, harder to get to, you know, hard, you know, crawling through brush and stuff like that. So I think hunting areas like that this past few years has really helped my success. And, you know, couple that with my aggressive hunting style, I consider myself pretty aggressive. Just those two things alone, I think, have been the biggest keys to my success the last few years.
Okay. I guess the specifics of that saddle setup, you're using a Phantom, I'm sure. As far as your climbing method, are you using spurs for the most part pretty much, or are you also using sticks every now and then?
Yeah, both. In West Virginia, I can use spurs, so I use spurs a lot here. And then if I'm on like or whatever, I can't use them. I've got some I've had sticks that I use with my haters. And using the Phantom style, we used it this past year during testing, and you know, we don't plan on it this year. So got my system pretty well dialed in. I got changes this year, but you know, I'm running about as light as I could possibly get, but it's been pretty nice the past couple years with the gear that's coming out and that we get to use. And it's a far cry from the 50-pound climber that I was looking around.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, ever since we were in Missouri and we got to try the new tethered Phantoms, Sam has been in love with the comfort channels. and she has never once yet hunted out of an actual tree stand. We've hunted on the ground a couple times, and we've hunted out of saddles, and that's pretty much all she knows. So the big thing for her this year is getting her climbing method where she can get more than 12 feet off the ground without carrying in an extra 15 pounds of stuff.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I kind of dealt with the same thing this past year with my son. He's 11, and instead of, you know, starting him out with a tree stand, I just started him out with a saddle, and you know, just the climbing aspect was the hardest part for sure, getting high enough and all that. So that's definitely something to figure out.
Mm-hmm. Are you using, when you use sticks and aiders, pretty much just like three sticks? Would that be pretty average, or does it vary? Do you sometimes bring in four, sometimes two on those areas that you have to use them?
Usually three. I find three is usually enough. With an aider, I can get over 20 feet pretty easy. And then I'll, you know, from the top stick, I'll set my platform another couple feet above that. So I'll kind of have a big step up over the platform. So I usually find that three gets me high enough. And unless it's, you know, late season and there's no leaf cover, and then I find myself where I need a little bit more. But for the most part, I'm running three, and that gets me by.
Cool. And I'd imagine too, you probably always have the option of just once you have your third stick up, just one stick moving that last stick up to your a next higher height.
Yeah, I've definitely done that before, and that's always a good trick to know, just so you don't have to carry an extra stick. So it's definitely nice.
Do you have any luxury items in your setup, or do you try and be as minimalist with everything as possible?
Not really. I really don't carry a whole lot, these days. I've got the camera gear that I take, and I've even got that whittled down to like just the bare essentials. So there's a lot of times I won't even carry a second angle. I don't like carrying all that stuff. So I've basically got a knife and my headlamp and the rest of just camera stuff. So if I didn't have that, I could go without a pack and I would be totally fine. But I've been filming for years, so I just pretty much have to carry it with me. But if it wasn't for that, I'd be really, really light.
Yeah, for sure. I'm kind of the same way where I try and pare that stuff down as much as I can. I've almost been even doing the opposite where you're getting rid of all your extra angles and just keeping the main, camera rig, and I've been trying to get away from the main camera rig and just keeping the extras.
That's actually a really good idea, and I've actually thought about that, trying to kind of do what you do and, use the head cam and some other stuff to make a video instead of the main camera. That would be really nice actually to get away from the camera arm and all that.
Yeah, it just seems like there's a lot of times where it gets in the way, and either the extra movement is something that causes me to get spotted, or I know I wouldn't have gotten spotted if I hadn't had the camera arm and wanted to make the movement, or looking down to look at the LCD screen. Whereas with the head cam and just the second angle's running, I can just focus on hunting, really, assuming that I have everything running and, externally powered and all that stuff. The trickiest thing is just getting good audio. If you only have like one second angle running and you don't have great audio connected right to it, which usually you don't with action cams, then that can be the toughest part.
Yeah, for sure. I know that messing with a main camera has cost me several deer over the years, so it's definitely frustrating, but I guess I haven't just explored, I haven't explored the options like you use to make it easier. So I may have to look into that, like with the 360 camera and stuff like that. It would definitely make it easier if, it doesn't look like you're going to get the shot on the main camera, just kind of ditch it and,
Right.
let the other cameras capture it. So that would be nice.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at my last, like, I think 5 kills on camera, I don't know that I had the main camera running for. I don't know if I had the main camera on the deer for any of them, but I've gotten head cam footage of almost all of them. One of them, Shane, was filming from a different tree, which obviously that's like the gold standard if you can get away with a camera guy. But yeah, I'll tell you right now, even without a main camera, just there's no perfect setup. I haven't found like the perfect. There's always like little things and quirks that I just hate about even the setup that I have now, and wish that I could make better. But I'm not, when you get into the electronics like that, there's just not too much you can DIY.
Yeah, for sure. I'm like you. I've got them set up to where it's about as good as it can be, and there's nothing really out there that's better yet. I'm hoping that somebody will come along with a camera arm that's super small but really stable, but I haven't seen any yet. I'm hoping that somebody comes out with something here soon.
Yeah, it seems like there's definitely a trade-off there with compactness, weight, and just stiffness that you'd like to have.
Yeah, for sure. It's hard to get all those things in one camera, but I'm still hopeful that somebody will have one in the future.
Once turkey season rolls around the corner pretty quick here, are you going to be just using a normal camera tripod and like a shotgun mic? Is that pretty much your setup, or do you use something a little bit different, or do you use a DSLR still for turkeys?
Yeah, so I have used the DSLR the past couple of years, but I've got the Sony AX700 quarter, which I'll probably be using that this year with tripod, and probably just one second angle camera. I don't like to carry a whole lot in the turkey woods, so I usually just leave the camera on the tripod and, carry it in my other arm like a second gun. So I
Yep.
try to stay away from, because I'm constantly moving and all that, and running gun hunting, so just try to go as light as I possibly can.
Do you carry a decoy too, or are you just basically try and use the terrain to your advantage?
So I carry a decoy with me, and I rarely use it. I don't think I'm going to even carry it this year. I'm at the point where I'm pretty decent at using the terrain and setting up, so when they come around a corner, logging road or something like that, they're already in range. So I think I'm just going to ditch the decoy this year, and I feel like it hurts me more than it helps me, honestly.
Yeah, I'd say I definitely would like to not have to carry it, for sure. I've had some instances where it seems like it doesn't do anything and it's just like dead weight. And I've also had some instances where, say for example, a couple of years ago I was archery hunting, run and gun, and I stuck a big half strut Jake in the middle of a logging road as a bird was coming in, and was literally, just tucked into some brush like less than 10 yards away. And that Tom came in and he started attacking that decoy, and I was able to get the full draw and get an arrow off. And I know for a fact that would not have happened if that decoy wasn't there. So
Yeah, for sure.
that's,
Yeah, and I've had the same thing. Yeah.
yeah. Archery hunting, which I bought an archery tag in Minnesota just so I could hunt the whole season. I'll definitely bring a decoy out for that. But yeah, I'm on the fence if I'll carry one just like you for the remainder of the shotgun seasons, especially in hilly type of terrain when you can really use that terrain to your advantage, or late in the season when you got that thicker foliage and you can use even like bends in the trail like you mentioned.
Yeah, for sure. And like you said, there's been situations where the decoy has absolutely, made the difference. And then, it just seems like 90% of the time it's dead weight. So I don't know. I feel like I'd be just fine without it, but I'll probably go a couple hunts and then it'll be back in the pack.
How many birds are you able to kill in West Virginia?
So we can kill two here. Our season starts April 20th, and we can only hunt until 1 o'clock, and we can't hunt all day like at any point of the season, so it's always the clock cut off, but we can kill two birds here.
Do you hunt other states too, or is it pretty much just West Virginia for turkey? I know you've killed a ton of birds over the years, it seems like, in West Virginia.
I'll travel a little bit this year, hopefully. Plans have kind of changed a little bit with this whole virus thing going around, but I'm going to try to make it to Tennessee here in maybe 2 weeks. I was supposed to go to Alabama with Parker McDonald, and that, we kind of nixed that just because of all this going on. Really wasn't sure about travel, but I'm definitely going to hunt West Virginia, possibly Ohio, maybe later in the season. And hopefully Tennessee. So maybe three states this year. One for sure, West Virginia, but I
Yep.
don't know. We'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, I may, there's a small chance, be joining you on that Tennessee trip. I was
Nice.
just talking to Greg today. The flights are dirt cheap, to get down into that
Oh,
area
yeah, I'm
right
sure.
now from Minneapolis, but I mean, there's a lot of things to work through, and I'm like I mentioned before we started recording, I'm still working full time, and so is my wife, so. We'll see. I have to work some things around logistically and see if it makes sense or not, but there's a chance.
Yeah, it sounds like it'll be a fun trip. So I'm trying to work that out now. But yeah, like I said, our season doesn't open until April 20th, so I've got some time to go to, hopefully to another state. And I definitely like to get after them. I'm seeing all these people killing them right now. It's kind of making me jealous. So I'm
Oh, I
trying to get
know.
out there.
Yeah, it's tough to film hunts when you're, especially up here. I don't know how late your season goes, but our best hunting is like late May when most of the people have like moved on from turkey hunting. They're more just interested in like fishing. and grilling hamburgers and stuff. So it's like I'll post videos in like late May, and it's like nobody watches them because nobody cares anymore.
Yeah.
Just hang on to it for next year.
Yeah, I know by the time May hits, I'm in the smallmouth mode, and I've had enough of them, and usually I'm frustrated with them by that point. Every year is pretty tough in the hills, so usually 2 weeks of it going hardcore, and I'm fed up with them and ready to do something else.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're definitely always welcome to come up if you guys ever want to make a trip to the Upper Midwest. We got a bird season in Minnesota, but a ton of public land in Minnesota, and same thing with Wisconsin, a lot of public land. And Wisconsin, you can shoot pretty much as many birds as you want to buy tags for in the later seasons anyway.
Nice. Yeah, that's cool. I haven't ventured out too much for turkeys yet, but you know, I'm hoping to in the next couple of years. But yeah, it's definitely fun now.
Cool. Well, I think we covered a lot of stuff. It wasn't a terribly long podcast, but I mean, you gave some pretty good insight, especially on that real breakdown of that, you know, older buck that you shot.
Yeah.
That was really good to get some visualization on exactly how that worked and to really know that and gave confirmation to how that style can be really effective and specifically how you can set up to make it actually work out even when the deer seemingly has a lot of the things in his advantage.
If, you know, if any of your listeners want to see that hunt that I was talking about there, you know, if you go to my Flinging Arrows YouTube channel, I've got a video on there called I Ambushed a Buck from His Bedroom. I think that's what it's called. And I kind of break that hunt down and how I access the area and all that. And it'll give you a little bit more insight on actually a lot of my hunts kind of set up in a similar way in hill country. So if you want to check that out, and it'll kind of give you an idea of how that hunt went down.
Okay. And that channel Flinging Arrows, that's spelled FLINGINAIROS. One word.
Yep. You got it. Yep.
Gotcha. Cool. Where else can people find your stuff? Are you on Instagram or Facebook or anything like that?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram at J_SHAF30. We also have another YouTube channel, me and a good friend of mine, called Hunt Appalachia, if you want to check that out. And I do a lot of the stuff for Tethered as well, so I'm kind of all over the place. But
yeah, pretty much all the, at least a large majority of the Tethered marketing material is your handiwork, right?
Yeah, that's kind of my job now, or has been since last August. So I get to do all that full time now, which is pretty cool. But yeah, I get to do all the promotional and, you know, photography and stuff like that. So it's pretty cool deal.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate having you on.
Yeah, it was fun. It was good talking to you.
That'll do it for this episode. As always, make sure to follow the Sportsman's Nation on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Leave us a review on iTunes. And if you're looking for additional content from Bobby Boswell or myself, subscribe to DIY Sportsman and Boudreaux Boswell on YouTube. And with that, thanks for listening.